Didn't we see these guys on WrestleMania?
Welcome to episode 177 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, September 4th, 2011. I am the Solo Monster. Hope everybody stateside is having a good Labor Day weekend. And no major breaking news stories to get to, but a ton of other stuff to get to. Raw, SmackDown, Impact, all of which I did see this week. Plus a couple of other news items, your questions, all that good stuff. Before we dive right into it, I just want to mention off the bat, those of you who may have missed it, I penned, or I guess I didn't pen, but I typed up an editorial for SCScoops.com, my first editorial since February, so I've been slacking off on that, but an editorial that went up on Tuesday on the website, and there is no section that I can tell. I think we used to have one for editorials and such, so you're going to have to just scroll back and find it if you didn't already read it. It was posted last Tuesday. And basically, it was looking back 18 years later at the SummerSlam 1993 main event of Lex Luger and Yokozuna, and kind of tying that into the question of why is it so damn difficult to book pro wrestling? I actually have an answer for that question at the end of the column. So some really fascinating stuff looking back on that main event, the way they promoted it, the way they hyped the hell out of Lex Luger and his all-American push trying to make him the next Hulk Hogan, and the unbelievably god-awful finish to that pay-per-view. So it's an entertaining read. Go back and check it out if you did not already do so. Leave your feedback and let me know what you think. So I just wanted to let everybody know about that. With that out of the way, we move on to what was a Raw Super Show this past Monday night. And what a weird show this was, I think is really the best way to describe it. You know, we had some really good wrestling. We had some mind-bogglingly stupid booking decisions. And a roster announcement that I thought was long overdue before I later realized that it only applies to one show. So apparently the brand split is not officially kaput, at least not yet, as SmackDown stars will be appearing on Raw per Triple H for the foreseeable future, but not vice versa, save for the odd super show every now and then that SmackDown has. So, you know, I'm going to talk more about this in a second. I'll get to all that, don't worry. But the announcers on this show, the other thing I wanted to mention, were not as bad as they were a couple of weeks ago, but they took a big step back this week with their incessant bickering back and forth. And what else on this show? The WWE Champion was nowhere to be found. He was having visa issues, which have since been resolved. He was actually back with the company on their tour of Puerto Rico this weekend. I think he actually had two matches in one night. He might have, from what I read, had a match against CM Punk and John Cena. So Del Rio was back, but he was nowhere to be found on this show. And I'm not necessarily against the idea of keeping your champion off TV every now and then to keep him fresh, but that's not why it happened. So much of the show was about promoting the live Super SmackDown that was coming up the next night on Sci-Fi, the big Tuesday Night Live show, which they did a very good job of that, I felt, until the main event finish of the show, which I hated. Hated! Get to all that. We're going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. As always, we'll start with the good. There was a lot of that on this show. The opening segment with Triple H, CM Punk, and Kevin Nash was really good stuff. And I've been wanting to talk about this all week because there was a bit of a war that erupted on our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheSoloMonster. And among other places, I mean, you know, my Facebook page was hardly the only place where there was a heated debate about whether or not this was a good storyline, whether or not this whole storyline with Triple H and Punk and Nash makes any sense. A lot of back and forth, people waiting for my opinion on it. So basically, my thought is this. This particular segment on Monday night I really liked. I thought they did a very good job of setting up CM Punk versus Kevin Nash at Night of Champions, although by the end of the show, this made absolutely no sense whatsoever. The changing of Punk vs. Nash to Punk vs. Triple H, which is what they did at the very end of the show, was confirmed as being due to some sort of health issue involving Kevin Nash. He had gone to Pittsburgh a few weeks back to do his medicals, which is pretty much, you know, standard procedure for any new superstar who's coming in to compete in WWE. If it's a new guy, if it's an old guy coming back, whatever the case may be, you have to go through certain medical procedures. As a matter of fact, when Nigel McGuinness came over from Ring of Honor, originally he had signed or was going to sign with WWE, and the reason he ended up going to TNA was because something major came up in his medicals that precluded WWE from signing him. course, TNA snatched him up. And, you know, he had a couple of good months there, had some good matches, and then I presume whatever ended up happening was the same medical issue that gave WWE pause, and Nigel McGuinness is now retired as an in-ring competitor. Anyway, in this case, Kevin Nash goes in, they find something, and they decide, okay, we can't have him wrestle. And there were different reports that said, you know, in a different day and age, this is not the sort of thing that would have prevented Nash from wrestling, but they're more cautious now. They have a wellness policy. They try to stick to the letter of the policy. Perhaps a doctor suggested it, and they didn't want to put themselves in a position where if we go against what the doctor says, then, God forbid, something happens to Nash, we're liable. So Kevin Nash, for that reason, was taken out of this match. And keep in mind, this is the same Kevin Nash that has a history of health issues when it comes to doing a job on pay-per-view. He no-showed his match with the Giant at Starrcade in 1997 because of what he thought might have been a possible heart attack at the time. Supposedly, it turned out to be a very bad case of indigestion. Okay. Fast forward a couple of years, the TNA Bound for Glory pay-per-view in 2005. Nash was scheduled to lose to Jeff Jarrett in the main event, and he pulled out right before that match after another heart scare. So, you know, was it all legitimate? Who knows? I'm not going to say whether it was or it wasn't. All I'm doing is I'm pointing out some very peculiar cases of past times when Kevin Nash has been in a high-profile match on a pay-per-view where going in, the plan was that he was going to lose. That's all I'm saying. So apparently WWE was aware of the situation with Nash at least a full 2 days in advance. This is important, okay? They knew about this at least 2 days in advance, and they still went ahead and decided to announce the match at the beginning of the show, and later on in the same show, they had Nash powerbomb Punk for a second time in a couple of weeks before pulling the plug and putting Triple H in there. Now, I love the visual, I've said this before, of the jackknife powerbomb, but this is now the second time that Nash has laid out Punk without any sort of retribution, you know? And now, if they even end up having a match, which, you know, if they do, it's a couple of months away. Because Nash apparently will not be permitted to return to action until the fall. Now, these are the reports that came out. You know, for all I know, come Raw this Monday night on Labor Day, wouldn't shock me at all if they inserted Kevin Nash into this Triple H Punk match at Night of Champions and made it a three-way. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. And quite frankly, I think it would be kind of dumb to make the match, cancel the match, and then stick Nash in there anyway. I'm just saying, nothing at this point would surprise me. But the fact is, who even knows if we'll end up getting a Punk-Nash match at all at this point? I mean, if this guy weasels his way out of putting Punk over, which was the plan from the beginning, if they went through the trouble of bringing him in, having him lay out Punk at SummerSlam, he laid out Punk on this show, he basically punked out Punk week after week. Punk got the better of him on the microphone. But what did Punk do to him physically, really? He got a couple of jabs in on SmackDown, and then he got laid out again with a big boot. If Nash weasels his way out of this, he truly is the smartest man in wrestling. I mean, without question. Without question. Now, the story here in this segment was that Nash lied to Triple H, who said that he couldn't trust Nash anymore. He told him to go away, don't come back. Nash said that John Laurinaitis signed him to a very lucrative deal, so he's here to stay. And as the two of them bickered, Punk started making these really obnoxious gagging sounds, like he was vomiting from their horrible acting. Punk was actually really annoying here, and I haven't said that about him at all until this point. Punk thinks they're both lying. He thinks they're both in cahoots. And he insulted Stephanie McMahon again. I think he said Triple H was wearing Stephanie's panties at one point. Overall, I really enjoyed the segment. Again, the Punk-Nash dynamic, you know, announcing the match, pulling the match, absolutely no sense. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. However, I'm not saying the overall storyline doesn't make sense. I'm not agreeing with people who say this whole storyline doesn't make sense. I actually think the storyline makes a lot of sense. It was just this one stupid, stupid thing they did on Monday night that I don't understand for the life of me that made absolutely no sense. Overall, the storyline to me is actually quite clear. You know, clearly they're building up this bad blood between Triple H and CM Punk going back even before SummerSlam. You know, and at SummerSlam, Kevin Nash is there. He claims that a good friend of his who he presumes is Triple H, I guess because Triple H's number came up on his phone, texted him and said, whoever wins the match, take him out, which is what Nash did. Triple H denies that he had any knowledge of this. He says, I didn't do it. It's not me. You got the wrong guy. And Punk, of course, doesn't believe either one of them. He says, you guys have been buddies. You're part of the clique. I've heard stories about you. I don't trust either one of you. He wants to beat up Kevin Nash because Kevin Nash basically cost him the championship. I'm surprised Punk isn't more angry with Kevin Nash. You know, at the end of this segment on Monday, Nash and Punk were face-to-face alone in the middle of the ring before they went to commercial break. Why didn't Punk attack him then? Why did he just stand there and stare in his face? That was kind of dumb. So anyway, Nash now is signed to a contract. Why would Triple H be so upset? I hear other people saying that as well. Oh, well, why was Triple H so upset when Kevin Nash said that Johnny Ace signed him to a deal? Well, put yourself in Triple H's position. Triple H is the COO of the company. He's supposed to have knowledge of everything that goes on. If not, be the person who signs people to contracts. Now, Johnny Ace is the head of talent relations, so, okay, he went ahead and signed Kevin Nash to a contract. Triple H is upset not because his best friend got a contract, but because Johnny Ace went behind his back, pulled a power play, signed a pretty big name, his own friend, and he wasn't even aware of it. And that's a subplot to this whole storyline that I think is kind of underappreciated, and I like, is the subtle heat between Triple H and John Laurinaitis. Is Johnny Ace fucking with Triple H's head, you know, as a favorite of Vince McMahon? Is Vince McMahon pulling the strings behind the scenes? I'm sure he's going to come back at some point. You know, what's going on there? There's that subplot to this storyline that I actually think is kind of cool. So overall, this actually makes a lot of sense so far. But what they did at the beginning of this segment, signing the match between Nash and Punk when they knew Nash couldn't go, really, really dumb. So hopefully that puts this to bed for all the people who wanted to know my thoughts on it. I think, you know, right now, until they really fuck it up, I'm curious, I'm anxious to see who sent the text and where they go with it. And, you know, now we've got a singles match at Night of Champions with Triple H and CM Punk. I'll get to that a little bit later on. I have my concerns about that, obviously. Randy Orton beat Dolph Ziggler on this show in one hell of a match. You know, Ziggler is so great at selling and taking bumps. He reminds me a lot of the late Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, which is a good thing, not a bad thing. Orton caught Ziggler with a sudden RKO, scored the pin, but this was every bit, to me, as important a performance for Ziggler in my eyes than his Royal Rumble title match was with Edge. You know, on this very show, at the beginning of the year, when they announced it was Dolph Ziggler and Edge for the World Heavyweight Championship at the Royal Rumble, I said that was an important match for Dolph. You know, he couldn't go into that match and get nervous or screw up or botch a million moves without suffering repercussions from that. And coming out of that match with Edge, I thought he had a damn good performance. And it's not as though Ziggler has exactly been pushed to the moon since then, but it's also key to keep in mind he hasn't exactly, in my eyes, been buried. I mean, he is capable of a lot more. He's got a lot of potential. It's just a matter of whether or not they give him the chance to run with it. This match with Orton was very similar to the match with Edge. I thought he came out of it looking like $1 million, even in defeat. This was a big win for him. I'm putting CM Punk and The Miz in the good category, but barely. I thought they had a good match. It was hampered by a crowd that was so quiet. I mean, you could hear a pin drop. I feel like there's still a certain segment of the WWE fan base that doesn't quite know what to make of CM Punk. You know, they don't know whether he's a heel or a face. This match could be a glimpse, to me, of a future program, you know, because Punk and Miz are two guys that have never had one before, and I think it's inevitable that they will at some point. I thought they worked well together, but the crowd really did no favors to either guy in this match. I liked how Punk had incorporated the Randy Savage elbow into his arsenal. I think that's really cool. You know, he points to the sky and everything like Savage used to do. R-Truth interfered in this match. He caused the DQ, which is, you know, perfectly fine. They beat down Punk 2-on-1 until Nash came down to the ring to pick the bones. That's when he gave Punk the jackknife. And, I don't know, to me this all had a very old-school Attitude Era style feel to it, this whole, you know, DQ into the post-match beatdown when Nash came down and all that. I have no idea why. It's just kind of the way I felt. But I liked it. I liked what they did. Now the bad. Oh, the bad. I am all in favor of mixing the brands, if not ending the brand split outright. I've said that before. But it seems to me like WWE is comfortable with just half-assing it here and having SmackDown guys officially on Raw, but no Raw guys on SmackDown. And I know their mentality behind it. SmackDown house shows are not doing well at all. And quite frankly, SmackDown is looked at as the number two brand. You know, it always has been, except for, I think, one period in that 2002-2003 period where you could argue SmackDown was the number one brand. It's always been that way, and I think it's always going to be that way. Raw is just the flagship show. It's been around longer. When people look back fondly on those days in the late 90s, the Monday Night Wars, it was the Monday Night Wars. It was not the Thursday Night Wars or the Friday Night Wars. And so they want to get some rub for the SmackDown guys by putting them on Raw. They don't feel the Raw guys need that, so why put them on SmackDown? That's their mentality behind it. I disagree with this, you know. My whole thing is this. Either do away with the split altogether, or keep the split and honor it accordingly. You know, as it now stands, if I'm a mid-card level talent on Raw, I'm really worried about my spot right now. You know, if the whole point of the brand extension is to get those guys on TV more often, when they otherwise would be shut out, how does this help guys like R-Truth and John Morrison and Alex Riley and Jack Swagger? You know, it opens up the talent pool, yes, but if you've got an angle-heavy show or a go-home show 1 week before a pay-per-view that's not focused on those guys, they're not going to get a spot on the show at all. You know, and now they can't show up on SmackDown either. Well, that sucks for them, doesn't it? You know, we'll give it time. We'll see how it works. I'm not going to judge it entirely in 1 week. I could be completely wrong about this. You know, maybe it actually helps those guys. But unless they can show up on Friday nights as well, I just don't see how it benefits them. I really don't. I just think you either end the split, or if you don't want to end the split, that's fine. But honor the rules. Raw guys on Raw, SmackDown guys on SmackDown. You can't just have, oh, well, SmackDown guys on Raw, but hey, you Raw guys can't be on SmackDown. That doesn't make any sense. It just confuses people. The other problem is that we now have two world champions appearing on Raw, at least on some weeks. You know, maybe Randy Orton won't be on Raw every single week, but he's going to be on Raw more often. And he's got the World Heavyweight Championship. Of course, Alberto Del Rio is the WWE champion. If ever there was a time to unify the titles, now is that time. You know, there's just no reason to have two belts on the same show. This is one reason why people don't see them as anything special. And for the people that have emailed me to ask if this means that they're thinking about a unification match at next year's WrestleMania, you know, don't bother asking me. You know, we went through this last year when they really were thinking about it and they decided against it. Now, I doubt they've even thought that far in advance. In fact, I know they haven't. I mean, for God's sake, on this very same show, they advertised CM Punk against the Great Khali for SmackDown the very next night. And that match ended up being changed to Sheamus and Khali. These people don't know what they're doing. You think they know what they're doing 8 months from now, let alone 1 week to the next? I mean, give me a break. So, 1 week earlier, Triple H gets in CM Punk's face, says that he promised the board he wouldn't get physically involved. Yet now the board is putting him in a match against CM Punk. This was the first thought that popped into my head when I saw that segment at the end of Raw Monday Night. And all I could think of is, huh? What? You know, the fact that they bumped the first Hunter versus CM Punk match up by at least a couple of months really stinks. You know, you have a creative team for a reason. There was no other interim replacement that you could have come up with. I mean, Punk and Triple H was a match they were obviously planning for the Survivor Series in November. Quite frankly, I think you could have gone even longer. I mean, you could have gone to the Rumble. You know, maybe WrestleMania is a little too far in advance. And I know the situation with Nash, you could say, well, they didn't have a choice. Bullshit, they had a choice. Like I said, you've got no fewer than half a dozen guys backstage working creative at any given moment. Their great idea was to just rush the Triple H storyline. I just think, you know, this is not the first time they've done this. They have a history of taking angles that they could stretch out for months and literally going through them, burning through them in just a couple of weeks. And it sucks, you know, for a company that loves to talk about how we tell stories. We're not a wrestling company. We're a storytelling company. Boy, do they suck at telling stories. I mean, my God, I mean, imagine your favorite novel, okay? Pick one. Doesn't matter what it is. Catcher in the Rye or whatever. You know, take a novel that's 330 pages, it has 35 chapters to it, and imagine if they literally, I can't even say cut it in half. I mean, if they took 80% of the story and condensed it in the first 20 pages, you know, would that story be as effective as it is in its current form? Of course not. It would suck. It's no different here. And I don't buy the whole, you know, oh, Kevin Nash had some sort of thing. We had no choice. You always have a choice. You can come up with something else. Give me a break. Now, the ugly. There was one thing on this show that I found very ugly, and that was the treatment of Christian. Now, I get that Christian is a joke at this point. I get that. You know, he's not meant to be taken seriously as a threat. They've certainly driven that point home very well over the last couple of months. He's lost clean a gazillion times to Randy Orton and has to cheat to win. That said, WWE was very serious about promoting Tuesday's live SmackDown show because they wanted to pop a good rating, which they kind of did. I'll get to that in a second. They want that show off of Friday nights. Okay, that was their goal. And I don't know if Sci-Fi, even with a good rating last week, is going to do that or not. You know, maybe we need a couple of more live SmackDowns, and if those do well, perhaps SmackDown eventually will move. But they were very intent on pushing that show as hard as possible, giving people a reason to want to tune in to watch it. Okay, it was a very big deal to them. And so you would think, you know, they book a cage match, a steel cage main event, with Randy Orton and Christian as the main event of this oh-so-important SmackDown show on Tuesday. And yet on this show, they not only have Christian take the losing fall in the tag team main event, it was John Cena and Sheamus against Christian and Mark Henry. Not only do they have Christian take the losing fall, but they make him look stupid, taking two finishers and then getting pinned 1-2-3. They make him look like a complete goof. Again, any other night, it's exactly what I would expect out of them. But how the hell is that supposed to make me want to see that cage match 24 hours later? You know, at least for one night, you should give me a reason to want to see that match. Have Christian do something so dastardly. I mean, Randy Orton had a great match with Dolph Ziggler. Why couldn't Christian come out and have, you know, some sort of heinous attack on Orton after Orton's match? Would have been perfect. It would have given some heat. It would have given people a reason to want to see Randy Orton beat the holy hell out of Christian inside of a cage the very next night. But they didn't do it. You know, again, give me a reason to think that Christian might actually have a shot at taking the championship from Randy Orton. I certainly wasn't left with that impression after the main event. That's for damn sure. You know, I understand it's likely would have been Alberto Del Rio apparently in this spot teaming with Mark Henry had he been available. But, you know, just like with the Kevin Nash stuff, that's no excuse. Put somebody else in there. You can't come up with any other person on the roster to put in that slot. You have to put Christian in there, and he has to be the one to take the fall. It's just stupid. So anyway, that leads into Super SmackDown on Tuesday night, which picked up a 2.1 cable rating, which everybody seems to be raving about, and they think it's a wonderful number. And, you know, 2.1 is better than what SmackDown does on average on Friday nights, which, you know, isn't saying much because Tuesday night is a much better night for TV than Friday night. You know, a 2.1 is obviously a hell of a lot better than what Impact does on a given week. But I don't know. I would have expected the show to do a little bit better. I'm not as blown away by that number as everybody else is. I mean, Sci-Fi put a press release out a couple of days ago. Obviously, they were very happy with the number. WWE was happy with the number. If I were WWE, quite frankly, I'd be happy to a point. I would not be doing cartwheels over a 2.1. You know, for as hard as they were pushing that show, it's live, it's on a Tuesday night, not a Friday night. I don't know, I would have expected at least a 2.3 or a 2.4, quite frankly, so, but that's just me. So, I enjoyed Super SmackDown, you know, even more so than Raw. To me, SmackDown was the show of the week. It wasn't, oh my God, what a fantastic show this is, but it was better than anything else we got this week. As I said on Facebook, I did find it rather disturbing during the contract signing when Triple H said that the board is allowing him to, quote, take off his suit for CM Punk, and that he has bent over backwards for Punk, and that he's going to make a man out of CM Punk, you know, and I, as I said, if he tells Punk to suck it this coming Monday, I'm done. I'm just through. And apparently he did tell Punk and Nash that he had two words for them on the during the promo on Raw last Monday. But since Triple H didn't actually say those two words himself, I'll give him a pass on that. So, appropriately enough, we had Super SmackDown start with Super Cena, who trotted out to some more lame-ass comedy, because God knows we don't have enough hokey Cena comedy on Raw Monday nights. Oh, no. So we need it on SmackDown as well. Booker T may have become the my favorite announcer of the year on WWE television when he made the comment that Cena made it to the top in spite of having limited skills. Yes, he actually said that, and it's not the first time that he said that. He said that at least once before on TV. Cena had a match with Wade Barrett. It went like 3 minutes. He beat him up, beat him with an attitude adjustment. You know, Cena's challenging Del Rio for the championship at Night of Champions, so that's exactly the outcome that you should have in a match like this. I'm fine with it. We had seen Junico, who had a really good match with Daniel Bryan, hampered only by those goddamn lights. My God, can they please get rid of those stupid lights already? I don't know one person who actually likes the lights. There were people at the beginning who thought they were kind of cool, and even those people now were like, get rid of the fucking lights. Daniel Bryan's losing streak after winning Money in the Bank continues after Junico hit the senton and the lion salt for the pin. After the match, when Junico went for the handshake, I thought for sure that Daniel Bryan was going to attack him and go heel. But much to my surprise, Junico kicked him in the head and left him laying. So this, obviously, my first thought coming out of this without even knowing anything, and this is after all the reports that Mystico was officially done with WWE, my first thought coming out of this was, they're going to bring back Mystico after all to show that an imposter has been playing the role of Sin Cara and the two will feud. You know, somebody pointed out, actually, that when Sin Cara got laid out by Sheamus at Money in the Bank, he was wearing a white outfit at the pay-per-view. So perhaps he can return wearing the same white outfit, and this guy can wear blue when they feud so we can differentiate the two of them. We'll have something to tell them apart aside from, you know, the height difference that does exist. Since this time, it's pretty much come out that Mystico is staying with WWE, which tells me that this is the only storyline possibility that they could possibly go with here. So I guess we're going to have the Battle of the Sin Caras coming up. Let's see here. I really enjoyed the contract signing with Triple H and CM Punk. In spite of the homoerotic overtones, I did enjoy it. I mean, seriously, I was about ready to say, oh, just fucking get it over with, for crying out loud. The crowd in Wichita did not react much to this segment at all. And by the way, if you are from Wichita, Kansas, and you were at this show, and you really like WWE, and you want more WWE shows, then boy, did you fuck up on Tuesday night. My God, was that a horrible crowd. Oh, my God. Yeah, not the best crowd. In fact, they didn't react to not only this segment, but much to anything on this show. I'm not going to blame them here in this particular segment, just because no matter how good the segment may be, it's still two guys in the ring talking, you know, instead of fighting. If I'm at a live event, I want to see action, you know, I want to see matches. So I can't fully blame them in this particular segment for not being as boisterous as they should have been. You know, what's worse is that half the stuff that they're yakking about here is going over the heads of about 85% of the people in the audience. But anyway, both guys were really good here. Triple H in particular was really on his game, no pun intended. I did chuckle at the part where he said the difference between Punk and himself was that he, that being Hunter, would actually look people in the eye or something to that effect if he was going to step on them behind the scenes. Oh, did I laugh at that one. I mean, there are legendary tales of Triple H saying one thing to a person's face and then screwing around with their push or their career behind their back in creative meetings. Anyway, the basic gist of all this is that Punk wants change. Triple H said that some people actually like WWE just the way that it is, and that Punk is only out for his own interests. Punk said the new Triple H sucks. He wants the Cerebral Assassin. And all I kept thinking here is, be careful what you wish for, young Obi-Wan. Be careful what you wish for. By the way, am I the only one who thinks that Punk is starting to come off as a real dick in this storyline? I can't be the only one who thinks this. Kevin Nash eventually lumbered down to the ring, got into it with Punk. Triple H tried to separate them, which allowed for Nash to catch Punk with a big boot. Then Hunter shoved Nash. Nash shoved Hunter on his keister, made a menacing face, and walked off. This was actually really well done. The eventual match with Nash is going to suck, but, you know, dare I say, I like how he's being used right now. You know, it's still way too early to be having the first Triple H CM Punk match, as I said earlier. It's completely ass backwards to do that match first as a way to build to a match with Punk and Nash, but whatever. You know, given the circumstances, it is what it is. Still the best storyline going in WWE right now, as far as I'm concerned. Sheamus beat the Great Khali by DQ after Jinder Mahal interfered. Nothing special. Sheamus is getting over nicely as a babyface. He busted out the Celtic Cross on Mahal after the match. And then we had a great main event with Christian and Randy Orton. It should be noted that Orton arguably had the two best TV matches of the week, if you include the Raw match against Ziggler. This was textbook pro wrestling right here. You know, you've got two guys who feud for months and months, and you blow it off with a steel cage match at the end. You know, that's what cage matches were originally designed for. Then you transition the champion to his next feud, which they did here with Mark Henry. The announcers talked about how evenly balanced this feud has been, which was completely preposterous. I mean, just completely ridiculous, and had to be some sort of inside joke. Orton has won every singles match in this feud, with one exception. And Christian only won that match because Orton kicked him in the junk. So, yeah. Evenly balanced, my ass. They went back and forth. Lots of attempts to escape the cage, mainly by Christian. They used the cage as a weapon. Lots of exciting near falls. I especially loved the spot towards the end where Christian leapt up onto the second rope and went for the move where he comes off with a sunset flip into a pin. It was the same move that Orton beat him with in their very first match, and he beat him with it at SummerSlam. But this time, Christian was smart enough to hold on to the ropes, and Orton delivered a phantom RKO to the Hollow Man, I guess. And Christian tried to scurry out of the cage like a rat. Great, great stuff. I love that. The match ended when both men were perched high above. They were sitting on top of the cage. And, you know, my hat's off to anybody who can do that. I think if I were a pro wrestler, I am afraid of heights. And I'm sure that if I were in WWE and they said, hey, you're going to be in a cage match tonight, or you're going to be in a Money in the Bank ladder match, I would just have to smile and say, okay. And deep down inside, I would die just a little bit, because even sitting safely on top of the cage 15 feet up like that would just scare the shit out of me. And these guys are sitting up there, they're hitting each other with everything they got, you know, waving back and forth as though one of them's going to fall off, and I don't know, that always gives me the creeps. But they're on top of the cage going back and forth. Orton brought Christian back over inside. Both men are standing on the top rope. Orton delivers a super SmackDown RKO for the 1-2-3. Orton retains. Christian loses again. A definitive end to a feud that will likely go down as the best of 2011 when it comes to work rate. These guys never had a bad match. Not once. I defy anybody to tell me one bad Randy Orton-Christian singles match these guys had this year. You cannot do that, because one does not exist. Some were better than others. You know, some were pretty good. Others were excellent. But they did not have a single bad match. You know, they were like artists in there, painting a masterpiece. So, bravo to both men. Out came Mark Henry, who I can guarantee will not be in the running for the greatest feud of 2011 based on work rate, but who cares? He's a scary mofo. I'm happy for Mark. He's getting the biggest push of his 15 years in WWE, and likely his last. So he is making the most of it. You know, he entered the cage, beat Randy Orton into oblivion, lawn darted him into the side of the cage a couple of times. It's hard to do an angle like this or do a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view and not have any blood. You know, it really does take away from things, but this was still very well done. I don't know what their plan is for Night of Champions, and let's be honest, neither do they. But I wouldn't mind it at all if they had Mark Henry beat Orton and take the championship. I mean, why not? Does anybody really care if Randy Orton holds the World Heavyweight title? It's obvious the Christian feud is done. So why not give it to Mark Henry? I mean, is it going to kill us to have Mark Henry as the dominant monster heel champion for a couple of months? It's already a second-rate brand that they don't care about, so who cares? I mean, there aren't very many other options on SmackDown right now anyway. So I'd pull the trigger on it, you know? I think you would kill Mark Henry's badass aura at the pay-per-view if he just eats an RKO and loses. Now, I could see them doing a finish at Night of Champions where Henry is about to win the match, or he's dominating Randy Orton, and out comes Big Show, out comes Kane. Obviously, Kozlov won't be coming out, but the people that Mark Henry has put on the shelf with an injury, you know, because Big Show and Kane were not really injured. They weren't, you know, they didn't do the storyline injury, as far as I know, to cover for a real injury. Those guys are ready to come back whenever WWE wants them to. Perhaps that's the finish, you know? So Henry, it's an out for them in that Henry doesn't lose clean, but perhaps Big Show and or Kane will come down to cost him the match. To me, whatever. I mean, I would not be a fan of that finish. I really think that Mark Henry deserves a run. You know, whether it's a couple of months, a couple of weeks, it doesn't matter to me. Give the guy a chance. So that was SmackDown. Much better show than Raw. I really enjoyed it. Which brings me to Impact. I actually did check out Impact Wrestling on Spike TV this week. This is the first of two tapings from Huntsville, Alabama, at the Von Braun Center. These are the first of what will hopefully be many more road tapings outside of the Impact Zone for TNA. Because God knows they have to get out of that damn building. I mean, my God, the difference is like night and day. I mean, it's not even funny. You know, TNA actually looks like a real wrestling company when they're on the road. Cool set. I think it's pretty much the same set they used when they were at in Fayetteville for the tapings back in February. It didn't look like they were going to have very many people at this taping. They did not have a lot of tickets sold at all. And there was a lot of walk-up, apparently, at the last minute. So they were able to get between 3,000 and maybe 3,500 people in there, which is still, you know, by TNA standards, that's a pretty damn good crowd. By the standards of almost any other national wrestling company, that crowd is not a good crowd, especially in a building that I think fits around 10,000. But I don't know how they did it, but they managed to, you know, darken certain parts of the building and spread people out enough where it looked like they had a pretty big crowd, even bigger, I think, than they actually did. So thumbs up TNA on that. Hulk Hogan comes out to start the show. And, you know, for all the great things I can say about TNA as far as, wow, this looks really cool, this gives the show a very fresh feel, Hulk Hogan and fresh, they don't go together. Hogan came out, and all I could do was shake my head. I mean, the guy is 1,000 years old. He can barely walk. I mean, I feel sorry for the guy. All the back surgeries, the knee surgeries, the fact that he's almost 60 years old. You know, some people can age gracefully. Some wrestlers get older, and they actually get better with age. Jerry Lawler at 60 years old, God bless the guy. He moves around like he's half his age sometimes. Even Ric Flair, who looks like hell, can move around a lot better than Hulk Hogan. Hogan could barely move, and all I could think is, this is supposed to be, I mean, this is a fresh start in many ways for TNA, and they've got a lot of really good young talent on this roster, and Hulk Hogan is the first face that you send out there. It really rubbed me the wrong way. You know, Hogan is obviously part of Immortal, he's part of this big ongoing storyline. The big match they're building to their biggest pay-per-view of the year for involves Hulk Hogan, which is something else I could rant about. He would not have been the first face I sent out on this show. But there he was. He came out. He said that the network has decided that Ric Flair's challenge to Sting is binding. There's nothing he can do about it. So Flair will wrestle Sting on the September 15th edition of Impact. That's right. Not on the No Surrender pay-per-view. Oh, no. They're going to give this match away on Impact in 2 weeks. If Sting loses, he will retire. If Sting gets lucky, as Hogan says, and beats Flair, Hogan will have to face Sting, presumably in a match of Bound for Glory in October. Now, anyone who is shocked that the match between Sting and Flair would take place on television rather than at the pay-per-view has been paying little attention to TNA over the last, I'd say 5 years, or to Vince Russo for most of his career. Okay? These people don't give a shit about making money. They don't. They're allergic to it. You know, it's like if they touch it, their eyes swell shut until you stab them with an EpiPen. That's TNA in a nutshell right there. Also, not having Flair do any interviews leading up to the match with Sting, unless they're not going to be done in front of the crowd, and they're going to be inserted into the TV show later on, which they won't be, is ridiculous. You know, the only thing Flair has left are his promos. And you don't give him a chance to speak, to build up the match. This is the first Sting-Flair match in 10 years. Actually, 10 and a half years. And you don't give him a chance to just really cut that go-home promo? I mean, it always puzzled me when he was in WWE why Vince McMahon would not give him the mic more often. I can never understand it. I never got an answer. Even in building up his retirement in 2008, You know, there's that one really memorable segment on Raw where he went off on Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels made the old Yeller comparison. That was the night that Flair brought the NWA belt with him, which he doesn't even own anymore because he put it up as collateral on one of the millions of loans he owes. But Flair went off on Michaels, slapped him in the face a couple of times, and, you know, it was a great, great promo. It was great work by Flair. But that was the only thing I remember, even leading up to the Michaels match at WrestleMania 24, unless I'm forgetting something. I can't remember very many other times when they gave Flair the opportunity. Just put the camera on him, even backstage. Doesn't have to be in front of the crowd. Go take a look at those old studio interviews he used to do on the old NWA shows in the mid to late 80s. Just put a camera on the guy, put a mic in his face, and let him do what he does best. You know, Vince McMahon hardly ever let him do it. He doesn't do it in TNA either. This could be the last big match that Ric Flair has. And again, unless they're going to insert something into the TV show next week, you know, because Flair didn't appear at the TV tapings. So unless they do that, he's not going to be on the show next week either. So it's just, I don't know. It just has me scratching my head. We had Gunner beat RVD. Anyway, before I get to that, Hogan made a main event. It was Kurt Angle and Sting for the World Heavyweight Championship. And Hogan said that he would be the special guest enforcer in the main event. Enforcer, of course, not referee, because, let's be honest, Hogan can't exactly get up and get up and get down and get down, up and down, up and down. He can't do that. So he said he'll be the enforcer. Gunner beat RVD to advance to the Final Four of the Bound for Glory Series tournament, for those keeping score. He joins Bully Ray, Bobby Roode, and James Storm. Crimson, by the way, who has had the most points in this tournament for what seems like months, was previously taken out by Samoa Joe in a backstage attack and injured. So he is out of the Bound for Glory series. As if this tournament wasn't already a joke. You take the guy that has been leading now for months and you just take him out of it. This tournament is a fucking joke. I went to the No Surrender page, by the way, on the TNA website to see what the matches are, and they have no matches listed. At least as of, I think I checked, the last time I checked it was Saturday night. It's the last time I checked. So, whatever. You know, I guess there's going to be two singles matches at the pay-per-view. Bully Ray versus James Storm and Gunner, I guess, against Bobby Roode, whoever has the most points at the end of the two matches. There will not be a third match. The winner will be the person with the most points, and that person will go on to Bound for Glory to compete for the World Championship. We had Mickie James beating Winter to regain the TNA Knockouts title. There was a promo video hyping the return of Jeff Hardy next week, which I missed, and I could not be bothered to go back on YouTube and check it out, but apparently, well, he is coming back next week. He was at the tapings. I talked about it last week. He does a promo at the end of the show asking for one more chance, as if he hasn't already had more than one chance. The crowd chants, give him one more chance, and so Jeff Hardy, I guess, is going to have one more chance. Mind you, he makes his comeback on that show next week. Next Thursday is the day that he goes back to court for his next continuance, so that'll be interesting to see if it, in fact, is anything but a continuance. I would be stunned if it wasn't. I guess we'll find out. AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels had a real good match, as you would expect from these two guys. Probably one of the better matches of the week, I'd say, behind Orton and Ziggler and Orton and Christian in the cage. This may have been the third best match of the week. A bit short, but still the best thing on the show, easily. Before the match, they were all buddy-buddy backstage. Keep that in mind. At the finish, AJ Styles went for a springboard leap off the apron and onto the top rope, but lost his footing. He crotched himself on the top rope, allowing Daniels to swoop in and score the pinfall. An odd finish, but I liked it. Gave it a real feel. You know, at any given moment, a mistake can happen, and your opponent can capitalize on it, so I dig it. Then they had to go and do bullshit sports entertainment after the match when AJ was man enough to extend his hand to Daniels, and Daniels just brushed him aside and walked off. Why would he do that? Because he's a dick? That was stupid. I don't know. I just thought that was really dumb. Then we had Kurt Angle and Sting in the main event. They had a perfectly fine match for the championship. Nothing more, nothing less. It was every TNA main event you've ever seen. Sting got Angle in the Scorpion Deathlock. Hulk Hogan waved the troops down from Immortal. Gunner ran down. He got backdropped by Sting, who still had Kurt Angle in the Scorpion Deathlock, mind you. Sting just bent over, and Gunner took a bump. Hogan grabbed a chair. He hit Sting right in the chest with it. but he no-sold it, which was kind of cool. And Hogan begged off for his life. Bully Ray came down, nailed Sting from behind. The rest of Immortal came down. Then Mr. Anderson ran down to the ring, chased everybody away with a baseball bat. Now, let's see if I had this right. First, he was a heel. Then he was a babyface. Then he was a heel. Now he's a babyface again. Do I have that right? I fully expected the Russo swerve at the end of this match here with Anderson attacking Sting, but thankfully that did not happen. And a fine episode per Impact standards. Not a great show, but nothing horrible. And the Huntsville crowd gave it a special feel, which just goes to show you, it's the same thing I've been talking about, a lot of people have been talking about for months now. Get that show out of Orlando. Seriously. I don't even go back there anymore. They should completely do away with the Impact Zone and just get their asses on the road, because that's the only way you're ever going to try to build credibility with this product. People are not going to look at TNA any differently. Well, first of all, people aren't going to look at TNA any differently unless you have a change in command at the very top. But besides that, one of the things they could do is get their shows into real buildings. And even if you only have 3,000 or 4,000 people in a 12,000-seat building, if you can mask all of that empty space and space people out enough and get them as loud and as boisterous as you can possibly get them, it will go a long way to making people appreciate your TV shows that much more. I mean, like I said at the beginning, Impact felt like a real wrestling show when they hit the airwaves this week and they showed that crowd and the enthusiasm from all those people. It just, right off the bat, it gave the show a completely different feel that held for most of the show, and it helped that the show wasn't overly horrible. And that's why I would say, pretty good Impact show. I'd give it a thumbs up. A couple of news items here. Santino Marella was injured in an auto accident a couple of days ago. He suffered a separated shoulder, as well as the assorted cuts and bruises. Thursday night is when the accident occurred. His car was struck by another vehicle, caused it to flip over and crash into a light pole. He was in Toronto getting ready for WWE's tour of Puerto Rico when he decided to go get a haircut. His barber wasn't in, so he went to come home, and that's when the accident occurred. The other driver remained at the scene when police arrived. No foul play is suspected. Best wishes for a speedy recovery to Santino. If you look at the photos on WWE.com, they did a whole article about it, and they posted four pictures. And my goodness, this accident could have turned out to be a hell of a lot worse. So thankfully, it was just a separated shoulder. Santino will be out for, I would guess, a couple of weeks, and hopefully at that point he'll be back on the road, so best to him. Kurt Angle made the news this week as well. He was insulted by being placed number 34 on WWE's Top 50 Superstars of All Time. Now, you might be wondering, well, what is this list? Is this a new list? No, this is the same bullshit list that WWE came out with for their DVD so many months ago, and what ended up happening is you can thank Mick Foley for this, because Mick Foley went on Twitter earlier in the week and said that he was happy to make the WWE's list, which I guess he only now found out about. He made the list at number 33, and Foley made the joke on Twitter. He said, "I don't think Kurt Angle would take too kindly to placing behind me at number 34. Well, Kurt Angle found out about this, and boy, he was not happy. He said that his first tweet was, "I was number 34 on the WWE all-time greatest. To tell you what, take me off the list. I'd rather not be on it," Angle said. "If he's not top five, he does not want to be on the list." And then he followed up with, "I have never been more insulted by WWE's top 50. Number 34 to me is a kick to the balls. Take me out of the ratings, please. You think fans will buy that crap?" So then an hour later, Angle must have recognized how foolish he looked, and he said, "Shawn Michaels deserves number one. He's been putting on awesome matches for well over 20-something years. I will not complain. It is what it is." And then by the end of the week, Kurt posted an apology, and all of a sudden he said he's okay with the list. He's got no problem with it. This is a great example of why wrestlers and Twitter do not go together. So first we have, let's see, Billy Graham, right? Super schmuck Billy Graham, who wants out of the WWE Hall of Fame. Remember his little outburst. Now we have Kurt Angle, who wants off the company's fake top 50 list, which of course is filled with petty and political picks and has absolutely no merit whatsoever. But for whatever reason, Angle takes this list very seriously. But he's okay with it now, so I guess all is well in that world. But my God, he looked like an asshole when it was all said and done. I mean, really, you're going to make a big deal out of this on Twitter? Come on, man. People need to start using their heads. I was very disappointed to read earlier this morning that the iconic Midcourt Tunnel, or as wrestling fans would probably know it, the Short Aisleway at the world-famous Madison Square Garden in New York City is apparently no more. It is a victim of the arena's ongoing renovations. For those who don't know, MSG has been closed now for the last few months, and I guess it's set to reopen just in time for the NBA season, I guess by October. But it has been closed all summer as they renovate the building. It's the first real renovations that MSG has had in many, many years. And you can go, they have a website set up for it. I forgot the URL, but if you type in Madison Square Garden, find the official site for the building, it will show you exactly what changes are being made. And apparently the Short Aisleway that has become a symbol of some of WWE's more famous MSG shows over the years is no longer there. It will be just like any other arena. This makes me very sad. You know, I remember, probably going back to the first WrestleMania, to be honest with you, but, you know, WrestleMania 10 and you know, Owen Hart coming down to the ring, Bret Hart coming down to the ring, Shawn Michaels walking around the ladder, Razor Ramon walking under the ladder. I'm trying to think. WrestleMania 20, they did not use the Short Aisleway. But they have for other pay-per-views that they've had there. Survivor Series back in 2002, Royal Rumble back in 2000, Royal Rumble back in 2008, which was a show that I was at. That was the Rumble where John Cena made his big surprise return. So if that's the case, and by all accounts it seems like it seems legit, this makes me very sad. It, you know, in a way it kind of gives MSG its own distinct identity. You know, it's one of the things that helps differentiate that building from any other arena in the world. And, you know, the Garden is still the Garden at the end of the day. Hopefully the changes they're making will make it a better place, a cleaner place. But I was very disappointed to read that this morning. I promised myself I would not spend more than 60 seconds max on Matt Hardy, so this is the only thing I'm going to say this week. On Tuesday, Matt Hardy teased his suicide with a YouTube video and managed to piss off a whole bunch of people in the process. His friends, family, the cops, even the bartender says that Scott Hall couldn't help but shake his head in disgust. Of course, Hardy did not kill himself. On Thursday, he released yet another video, this time apologizing for his actions. He called it a misunderstanding and officially retired as a full-time professional wrestler. And to that, I will say only that I hope he retires his YouTube account next. I think the guy is full of shit, and that's all I have to say about that. Time for your questions. Going to open up the mailbag here. Got a lot of good questions this week. We'll start with one here from Kingsley from the United Kingdom, Bolton, it says. I'm not quite sure what that means. Perhaps somebody can help me out with that. He says he is two-thirds of the Triple Threat, follows me on Twitter, is a friend on Facebook, will soon be getting an iTunes account. A fine man this person is. He says, I can remember reading something about AJ Styles when he rejected the chance to go to WWE about the year 2000 or so. And I also read on Steve Austin's Twitter a while back when he said the WWE should sign Samoa Joe and give him the green light push. Where do you think both AJ Styles and Samoa Joe would fit in WWE? I think they would fit in quite well. If I had to put them in a specific position, you know, a guy like AJ Styles, I think what I would do with AJ is what Triple H now is the head of developmental, or he oversees developmental in WWE, and his whole idea from here on out is to debut people with vignettes, very similar to what they did for Alberto Del Rio or Karma or Sin Cara, and I like that idea. And I think going that route with AJ Styles, you know, you can't use footage of him in TNA, so put some vignettes together, put them in a warehouse one weekend with, you know, one of the developmental guys, let them work a match, take some highlights from that. You tease AJ Styles' debut on television for about 3 or 4 weeks, and you have him debut on SmackDown. I think SmackDown is in dire need of talent. And you have AJ Styles work his way up the ladder on SmackDown. Now, with Samoa Joe, for Joe, I could probably come up with 5 or 6 different ideas. Off the top of my head, I've got about 2 or 3 different ones. You know, one, for example, it strikes me that Joe and John Cena came up together. You know, they both came up in, I believe it would have been Rick Basement's UPW out in California. So they're very familiar with each other. They're friends, or they were friends. And when I think of John Cena, I think of how stale things are. You know, he seems to always face the same people. Then he got into the feud with Punk. It was very fresh. Now he's feuding with Del Rio. When this is all said and done, we all know that at the end of the day, Cena's going to get the championship back at some point. And when that happens, I would love to see Samoa Joe come from out of the crowd and beat the living crap out of John Cena. Don't give Samoa Joe your, you know, the couple of weeks build up with vignettes. If ever there was a time to debut Joe as an impact player, go the Brock Lesnar route and have Joe come out of the crowd, come out of nowhere, and attack John Cena, and it leads right into a Joe-Cena feud. Okay, that's one way you can go with him. Another way you can go, you know, Joe and CM Punk are more than familiar with one another. They're both very good friends. They had some classic battles, 60-minute encounters in Ring of Honor. So as far as the two of them working together, you know you're going to get some really good stuff. And it strikes me that there's a history with Samoa Joe and Kevin Nash. Not always a rosy history, although at one point they were kind of partners with one another in TNA. So perhaps come up with some sort of idea where, as this storyline continues to evolve with Triple H and Punk and Nash, maybe at the very end, if we finally do get that big Kevin Nash CM Punk match, not that I want Joe to interfere and actually have Nash go over on Punk, that's not the outcome I'm looking for, but somehow get Joe involved in that storyline. You know, how he fits in there, I'd have to think about that a little bit more. But if it leads to a Joe Punk feud, or it puts Joe in a position where he's already right off the bat involved in a high profile storyline in WWE, instead of starting from the bottom and having to work his way up, we know what Joe is capable of. I think that would be another fine way, quite frankly. Third idea I'd have for Joe, if you didn't want to put him on Raw in something that high profile right off the bat, debut him on SmackDown. You know, you can have AJ on Raw instead of Joe, or maybe have AJ and Joe on the same brand, but either way, have Joe on the SmackDown brand and have a feud with Daniel Bryan. You know, Daniel Bryan, even though he's got the Money in the Bank briefcase, is hardly a high-profile guy in WWE right now. I mean, he hasn't won a match since Money in the Bank. He loses every week. You know, again, how you introduce Joe, I'd have to think about that a little bit more. But introducing Joe and putting him in a feud with Daniel Bryan on Friday nights sounds like a hell of an idea to me. Ernie in Anaheim, California, he's been a listener since episode 120. Yesterday, September 3rd, was his birthday, so I want to give him a birthday shout-out. Happy birthday to Ernie. You could say hi to Bert for me. Also, Akash from New York City is turning 16 on September 6th. He and his twin brother, who both listen to the Sound Off. How could I not give them a birthday shout-out? We have twins listening to this show now. If only we can get the Bellas to listen as well. Actually, you know what? Probably not a good idea to have the Bellas listen to this show on second thought. But anyway, happy birthday to Akash. And you don't give your brother's name, so if I'm your brother, I'm pretty pissed off right now. We also got an email from Gary. He's a listener from Singapore. He doesn't have a question, but he says he's a very big fan of the Sound Off, which makes every Monday very special for him, because it's a different time zone. So just keep up the good work, and keep bringing the eargasm to us. And I had to mention that, because I love that. I've never thought of the Sound Off as an eargasm, but I guess it is. Just, you know, bring the tissues and have a great time. I apologize. That was an appalling comment on my part. Got an email here from Dylan Siraki, writing into the Sound Off. Big fan. He says he was just thinking about Jack Swagger and Dolph Ziggler. Why? Anyway, he says he was thinking the last name Swagger is really bad, and that Dolph Ziggler is terrible. So in my opinion, what five WWE wrestlers have the worst ring names? Well, Kenny Dykstra, as opposed to using his real name, Ken Doan, I thought that was pretty shitty. You know, I'd be here all day. It's like I told Dylan. I'd be here all day if I went back and put together a list of all the shitty names WWE's cranked out in the last couple of years. You know, as far as Swagger is concerned, I actually don't think it's all that bad. You know, now if it were me, I would have kept the name that he used down in FCW, which was Jake Hager, which may actually be his real name. Jack Swagger, I don't know. I think it's okay. I don't see anything terribly wrong. I've seen far worse. You know, he got off real easy compared to some of the others on that roster. I mean, Michael McGillicuddy, awful. You know, Eli Cottonwood, laughable. Dolph Ziggler, don't even get me started on that one. Dolph Ziggler. I mean, that's probably the one name I've ranted about more than any other, because Ziggler's the one that actually has the potential to be something real special. And with that Dolph Ziggler name, I just he I cannot picture that in the WrestleMania main event. It's the old thing where if you talk to like an old school wrestler, and I've heard some of them use this analogy in interviews before, you know, they're still stuck back in the day where, you know, pre-internet, where you'd see your name on the marquee. You really don't see that anymore, by the way. You know, if you go to a show like a Raw taping or a SmackDown taping, you're going to see, you know, WWE Live or you know, Monday Night Raw or Friday Night SmackDown. I don't think it ever really says the name of a wrestler, unless it's just spitting out names like, you know, featuring John Cena, CM Punk, Triple H. Very rarely, I think, do you go to a building these days where it says, you know, tonight, John Cena versus, you know, Wade Barrett or something like that. But back in the day, it was all about what was on the marquee. You know, Madison Square Garden, some of the other big buildings, it would say Hulk Hogan against Paul Orndorff, where the big match tonight was Randy Macho Man Savage against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. And their whole thing is, if you can't picture that person's name being on a marquee, they're not worthy of being in that position. And with a guy like Dolph Ziggler, it's a shame, because I think he is worthy, but not with that name. He sounds like a really bad porn star. Actually, I have a funny story, kind of a funny story about Dolph Ziggler. A little anecdote. I don't think I've ever shared this on here before. The girl I used to date, probably earlier in the year, and I remember I was setting up the printer for her laptop. And when you set up a printer, you have to oftentimes give the printer a name. And I decided to name her printer Dolph Ziggler. It's the first thing that popped into my head. Don't ask me why. I have no logical explanation for it. It's the first thing that popped in my head. So I put Dolph Ziggler. And that was that. That was the end of it. So one day she happened to be watching one of the shows with me. I guess probably would have been on a Friday night. And Dolph came on. They flashed his name on the bottom of the screen, and she screamed. She says, "Hey, that's my printer." She had no idea where the name Dolph Ziggler came from. She probably thought it came with that name. It's some sort of foreign name. Maybe it's like a German printer or something. I don't know. But when she saw this guy on TV and the name Dolph Ziggler flashed on the bottom of the screen, she had a coronary. She wasn't angry. She was, like, shocked. She had no idea that I named her printer after a wrestler. And a wrestler with a shitty name at that. I never did find out, actually, if she renamed the printer. Quite frankly, I don't really give a shit, but I thought it was funny. Got a question here from Orlando, the person, not the city. In your opinion, who has the better elbow drop from the top rope, Shawn Michaels or Randy Savage? He says HBK does, since he could hit it with either elbow. What are your thoughts? Well, my answer is simple. Randy Savage, without question. And even Shawn Michaels would tell you the same thing. I'm pretty sure that even on Twitter, Michaels actually answered that question after a Savage died. He got a whole bunch of questions. And I think Michaels even said the same thing. So, Macho Man, hands down. Tom from New York writes in, longtime wrestling fan, loves the show. Am I the only one who thinks Sting should not be allowed to watch movies and blatantly rip off what he sees? He watched The Crow in 1996 and became that character, and now he's the Joker? I respect his talent, and he is indeed a legend in the industry, but this new Joker gimmick is a joke. I also was watching the WWE ECW One Night Stand show from 2006 and noticed an Essie Scoop sign in the crowd. Was that, in fact, you, as I know you are from New York? I didn't know that Essie Scoops was around for so long. I am hooked on the show. Well, first, Sting, in his defense, did not steal the Crow gimmick from the movie itself. Kevin Nash has actually told this story. It was Scott Hall who actually suggested it to him as an idea. So you can actually credit Scott Hall with the idea for the gimmick. As far as the Essie Scoop sign at One Night Stand, I don't know if you're... He mentions 2006 in his email, and there's a photo actually on my Facebook page. And please don't repost it. It's already there. But there's a photo from the 2005 event. So perhaps he also had a sign at the 2006 event. But the person you saw was not me. It was actually Webmaster Mike in the crowd. At least at the first One Night Stand. He had the Essie Scoop sign hanging over the railing. He was in the balcony. And I still regret not buying a ticket for that show, man. You have no idea. I really wasn't going to. I wasn't spending too much money on tickets to shows back then in that period for some reason. And, I mean, that first One Night Stand was in 2005. The next year, is when I started going to the Ring of Honor shows. I was actually going to a couple of Ring of Honor shows a year. And Ring of Honor at first was... the first Ring of Honor show I went to was in the New Yorker Hotel, which was actually right around the corner. Then they started having shows in the Manhattan Center up in the Grand Ballroom, and then eventually they made their way down to the Hammerstein Ballroom. So I was going to Hammerstein Ballroom shows quite often for a period from like 2007 to 2009, and why I didn't go to that show in 2005, I don't know. I still maintain to this day, watching on pay-per-view, that first ECW one-night stand show in 05 is one of my all-time favorite wrestling pay-per-views. You know, and this is coming from a lifelong WWE fan. You know, and I've seen a lot of great shows, and that show to me was maybe more fun than almost any other show, except maybe Money in the Bank. I will say Money in the Bank this year really did blow me away, but that first one-night stand, man, that was a hell of a show. Matt writes into the Sound Off, "Dear Solomonster, in the latest episode, you referenced a past show in which you discussed Jake Roberts and Scott Hall and wrestling death pools. What episode is that, and can I listen to it from SC Scoops?" I talked about Jake Roberts and Scott Hall during episode 41, and unfortunately, the earliest episode still actively archived online somewhere goes back to 42. You type in Solomonster Sounds Off and the word talk shoe into Google, you'll find a link very easily. So you just missed the cutoff there. I actually have that. I have all the early episodes under lock and key until I figure out what to do with them. Second part of his question here, the internet is abuzz with a CM Punk Stone Cold feud, and I personally would love to see the two clash. I was wondering if it's at all possible for WWE to structure a match to suit Austin's limitations. As you know, there's speculation that Austin may not receive medical clearance. Is it possible? Yeah, well, because I mentioned it on this show. Is it possible to structure a match in such a way so that his neck/spinal cord would be free from harm for the most part? Has this ever been done before? And as I mentioned to Matt in my email back to him, there is no way to do that. You can certainly structure a match to protect Austin as much as possible. For example, if they're going through TNA with this Hogan-Sting match at Bound for Glory, which I think is an awful idea, just absolutely awful, not just because the match is going to suck, but you're going to need all the bells and whistles and all the blood and weapons and outside interference just to make that match passable. And for a guy like Hogan, you know, for all the neck problems that Austin has had, Hogan is more well-known now for all the back problems that he's had. And it would appear that whatever, you know, that last back surgery that Hogan had all those months ago may have actually taken. You know, he actually is doing better. He's living in without pain, or at least less pain than he had before. He's got some of his quality of life back. What would possess somebody like Hulk Hogan, who has no reason to step back into a ring ever again, to get back in the ring and put his back and his body at risk is beyond me. It's that wrestling, it's that sickness that these guys have. You know, it's like Ric Flair. You know, everybody saw that article about Flair and all of his financial troubles, and we've heard stories about Flair for years. And, you know, Flair left a really bad taste in my mouth when I went to that TNA baseball show in at the beginning of July, and he was there backstage signing autographs, and he refused to come out in front of the crowd. There's been a lot of shit on Flair in the last couple of years. But my whole thing with Flair is that even if Flair wasn't destitute and in dire need of money to pay alimony and to pay all these people back and didn't live beyond his means, if Ric Flair had unlimited funds, if Ric Flair had $100 million and didn't have a care in the world as far as money, I fully believe that Ric Flair would still be wrestling because he doesn't know how to do anything else. And I think Hogan tries very hard to branch out into other things. He tries sometimes to separate himself from wrestling. He's tried to do movies. He's failed. Now he's got these other business ventures, which will also fail. It all comes back to wrestling for Hulk. But it's all he really knows how to do. Hulk Hogan, you know, nobody gives a shit about Terry Bollea. They care about Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is forever linked with wrestling, so it's all he knows how to do. And this poor bastard is going to step back in the ring and put his body and his back at risk for what? It's not worth it. And no matter how they structure a match like that, you're running a great, great risk. And to go back to your point with Steve Austin, you can only do so much. You know, if he agreed to come back and got medical clearance, and I'm not sure how he would do that. Because again, if he has the same injury that Edge has, Edge has already been told, even if you wanted to wrestle, and we wanted you to wrestle, you would never get clearance. It's not possible. So I'm not sure Austin could get clearance. Let's say he did, okay? Let's say his injury is a little bit different. He's going in there with CM Punk, who can be a hard-hitting guy. I'm sure Punk would do everything in his power to protect Austin. He'd bump for Austin. He'd take care of Austin. But you can't guarantee a person's safety. Anything can go wrong when you're in that ring. Just tell Darren Drozdov, you know, when he was in there with D'Lo Brown, who wasn't known, you know, back in the day to be a dangerous performer. Believe me, I could think of people who it was dangerous to be in the ring with. Ahmed Johnson comes to mind, Vader, Mark Henry, because these are guys who are very strong, they're very big, they're very clunky in the ring. Even if Punk is the safest guy in the world, he gets Austin up on his shoulders for the GTS. One wrong slip, one wrong move, it could be curtains for Steve Austin. There's only so much you can do. You know, I mean, if he wrestles, he's at risk. It's just that simple. You can play it safe. You can avoid certain bumps. Obviously, Austin is not going to take a pile driver or a power bomb. I think we know that. But you still got to take back bumps. You know, we saw Steve Austin on Tough Enough get in there and basically have almost like a mock match with Luke Robinson. And Austin looked pretty damn good in the ring. He was taking back bumps. You know, he got knocked down. He looked damn good in that ring. But that wasn't a real match. And Luke wasn't about to take liberties with Austin the way that perhaps somebody like Punk would do in the ring at WrestleMania. You know, your juices are going. You want to put on the best possible performance that you can. You're going to take back bumps. You're going to land on your neck. You're going to land on the back of your head. There's just no way around it. So at the end of the day, the ball is in Austin's court. And then it's up to the WWE doctors. And from there, who knows? I would love to see it. But not if the guy is going to, you know, run the risk of being a cripple coming out of it. It ain't worth it. Michael Avila writes in. He's a member of the Triple Threat. Love the editorial that I penned on SE Scoops. Coincidentally, he says, I was thinking about a rumor I read a while back where they decided, that being WWE, not to put the championship on Lex Luger at WrestleMania 10 because he got drunk and started telling people at the bar that he was going to get a push. Any truth to the rumor? It is an urban legend. Luger himself, actually, he's done some interviews in the last couple of years, and he himself has debunked this story and said that it was actually known months before WrestleMania that Vince told him he was not getting the championship. So I heard those same stories back in the day, and I was gullible enough to believe them. And like many things when it comes to stories like that, it's just a myth. It's not true. As a matter of fact, there was somebody who was trolling me in the comments section on SE Scoops underneath my editorial, if you go back and take a look. And he said that I didn't know what I was talking about, this guy said. And he actually cited that same story. And then later on, in our back and forth debate, he posted a link to an audio interview that Luger did a couple of years ago. And I figured he was supplying evidence to support his point. And when I clicked on the link and I read the transcript back, it was Luger debunking the very story that this guy was pushing. So it was a little bit odd. I thanked him for providing me with my own evidence, and he pretty much shut up after that, as they all do. Rory Bennett wants to know if referee Scott Armstrong's pin count bothers me. He says he noticed that Armstrong pauses in between each count, and it bothers the hell out of him. He just wants to know my opinion. I never really noticed. I have noticed in the past when referee Nick Patrick would do something similar back in WCW, and that used to annoy the crap out of me. I mean, he would drop down, and just his way of counting the fall, and then he had this wacky way of, like, waiting for the bell. It used to just piss me off. But with Scott Armstrong, to be honest, I've never really noticed. Brian P. wants to know, he's been a fan of the Sound Off since 135, since Kevin Nash is back and has an angle going on with Triple H and Punk, do you think Shawn Michaels will play a part in this at some point down the road? That's a very good question. Will he play a part of it physically as far as being a wrestler? No. I believe Michaels when he says that he is done. But let us not forget that very first night on Raw. It was the same night, if I remember correctly, it was the same night that Punk cut that promo on John Cena, that work shoot promo at the end of Raw, which would have been, I guess, the end of June. I believe the opening segment on that show had Punk come out with the Straight Edge Society and confronted Shawn Michaels in the ring. That was the night that Punk was kind of getting those digs in at Michaels. He said Michaels used to be a drug addict and all this other stuff, and he really made Michaels look kind of foolish. They could always link back to that promo. You know, not only are we talking about some of Shawn Michaels' best friends, but Punk himself has punked out HBK before, so perhaps at some point he shows up. I don't know what Michaels would do. Again, I don't see him getting physical beyond maybe a super kick, but you can't do a match between Punk and Michaels, so why tease something that you can't deliver? I mean, my God, if they brought Michaels back to, like, super kick Punk in the head, and they kind of teased us, but instead of giving us Shawn Michaels and CM Punk, they instead gave us CM Punk and Kevin Nash, what a cock tease that would be. So I don't even know that I would bother bringing Michaels back, but could they do it? Sure, absolutely. Bring him back for a promo or something. Why not? This question comes from Kevin, dear Solid Monster. What is your favorite entrance of all time? Mine has to be the 2001 Royal Rumble when Undertaker and Kane were cleaning house and seemed no one could stop them, and the next entrant comes out, the glass shatters, and Stone Cold comes to the ring. The crowd erupts. It was such a badass moment. That was a pretty good moment, but I have to say that I think my favorite entrance of all time, or certainly it's up there, I'd have to give this a little bit more thought, but it's going to be hard to top CM Punk at Money in the Bank in Chicago this year. That was just an amazing, just electric reaction from start to finish. The fact that the promo video was so great, and when the promo video finished, you know, WWE loves to build the tension and build the suspense, and they had this wide-angle shot of the crowd, and you could see people standing up. The music hadn't even hit yet, and they're already erupting into a CM Punk chant, and they chant, and they chant, and then it starts to die down just a little bit, and then they hit his music. And I like his new music, by the way, but I actually thought his old music, the Killswitch Engage song, fit him very well. I was actually sad to see that theme song go, but when that music hit, man, that place just exploded, and it did not stop until John Cena's music hit, and then it was perhaps the single loudest reaction. It was the loudest collection of boos at any one time I think I've ever heard in my life. I think if I was in the building that night, and perhaps if somebody listening was in the building that night, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but when Punk's music stopped, and they were chanting and chanting, and then John Cena's music hit, and the place went boo. If I were there, I'd probably feel the reverberations through my body. That's how loud it was. That Punk entrance at Money in the Bank was just magic. If I had to give just one or two other examples, they weren't exactly entrances for the beginning of a match, but they both involved Steve Austin coming down to kick some ass. Backlash 2000, Austin was supposed to be ringside for the main event. Triple H versus The Rock for the WWE Championship. Austin, as Vince McMahon had announced before the match, was had some sort of, I think he said he was in some sort of car accident. His car broke down or something, so Austin wasn't there. And towards the end of the match, when Rock is just getting his ass kicked in the ring by everybody, the glass shatters. Here comes Stone Cold, who, I'll never forget it, when he came out, the first thought that I had was, man, Stone Cold looks fat. And it's kind of unfair, because this was just a couple of months after Austin had his spinal fusion surgery. He had just gotten the halo off his head. And Austin had absolutely no business being on this pay-per-view doing anything physical. I mean, this is the neck surgery that people don't get clearance to come back from until at least 12 months. And in some cases, when like Rhino and Lita had their surgery, it took maybe up to 18 months for them to come back. This was maybe 3 months after Austin had his surgery. And here he comes lumbering down to the ring. He's got a steel chair in his hand, looking a little portly around the midsection. And the place is going apeshit. You know, Vince McMahon is sending anybody and everybody down the aisle to get to Austin before Austin can get to him. And Triple H comes running at him, gets kicked in the gut, chair to the back. Here comes Patterson, boom, chair to the head. Briscoe, boom, chair to the head. Austin slides the chair into the ring. And Shane McMahon, who had been the referee and had been knocked loopy, is getting up at this point. He's kind of groggy. And Austin just absolutely destroyed him with a chair shot to the head. Hit Vince McMahon in the head with a chair. Kind of fell on top of Vince McMahon, Austin did at that point, and called him a stupid motherfucker, if I remember correctly. I think that's exactly what Austin said, verbatim. And then he got up, hit Triple H with a chair. The place, from that point when Austin's music hit, until the point that Rock pinned Triple H a couple of minutes later, they did not. It was like the longest sustained pop for anything I've ever heard. It was incredible, except maybe one of those Hogan, you know, entrances in Canada after he turned babyface in 2002. But it was just electric, and he knocked out six people with a steel chair. It was great stuff. And the other moment would have actually been before that. It was the Rock Mankind match on Raw that Foley won the championship for the first time. Austin interfered in the match, but his music hit, which is always kind of corny. You know, when somebody's doing an impulse interference, do they really have to have their music played? I know it's pro wrestling. In this case, I'm actually happy they did it. Added to the moment. The glass shattered, and they had a crowd shot, like a wide crowd shot from the hard camera. And everybody rose to their feet. Just simultaneously, they stood up. And I think even Dave Meltzer was at that show. That would have been, I think that show was in Boston. So I'm not sure why Meltzer would have been on the East Coast. But if I remember correctly, he had said he was at that show, and it was the loudest pop he ever heard in his life. People were going nuts. And all Austin did, Austin was out with an injury. He came down. He walked to the ring again. Ironically, he went for the steel chair that was laying in the ring. And he walloped The Rock right upside the head with the chair. Pulled Foley on top of The Rock. That's when Foley won the championship. Again, huge reaction. And not a proper entrance per se, but still. Go back and watch that if you could find it on YouTube. It's one of those moments that just kind of stays with you. And it's just great stuff. I'm sure if I threw that question out to everybody else listening, you guys would probably come up with 100 different answers, you know, 95 of which are probably every bit as good as the ones that I just mentioned. But if I had to pick a real entrance off the top of my head, because it happened recently and it was just so great, CM Punk in Chicago at Money in the Bank was just awesome stuff. Prince Gitta writes into the Sound Off. Dear Solid Monster, I was watching the 21st Century Greatest Wrestler DVD by WWE. I guess that was Greatest Superstars of the 21st Century is what he means. He says, now I know that they are not allowed to use the WWF logo, but why is the WWE Scratch logo censored? And I mention this question not because I have an answer, because I have not seen the DVD, but I'm wondering if he's confused and perhaps he's thinking of the WWF Scratch logo from the Attitude Era, which, if that's the case, that's been going on now for years. That goes back to the court case where basically the Panda people won and they had to change their name to WWE, and the old kind of block letter WWF logo from the 80s and the mid-90s is fine, but that Scratch Attitude Era logo with the F in it, they have to blur it out. Now, if what you're telling me is that the current Scratch logo, the WWE Scratch logo, is being blurred, well, that makes absolutely no sense. But perhaps if other people listening have picked up a copy of the DVD, they can shed some more light on this. I'm willing to bet he's referring to the WWF Attitude Era Scratch logo, because if they're blurring out the current logo, what sense does that make? But perhaps somebody can shed some light on this on Facebook. Got an email here from Duck, if that is your real name. Just wanted to say hi and thank you for the great job you do on the Sound Off. I look forward to hearing someone who is a true fan of wrestling. I started going to watch wrestling at a very young age with my mother. Earliest memories are probably around the age of 5, so that would have been about 1969. And I am still a fan today. I live in Johnson City, Tennessee. There is a rec center here that has had wrestling every Tuesday night for years. At one point, it was a very busy little intersection for some of the biggest stars in the history of the business. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Duck. Thank God it's not duck season right now. Last question here that I'm going to be able to get to this week, kind of a fun one, comes from Gary, at Chris Dresden on Twitter. So if you're not following me on Twitter, then what are you waiting for? I'll get to that in a second. Kind of random, he says, but because you mentioned it on Twitter, that you recently watched the second Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie again, I have to ask, who is your favorite Ninja Turtle and why? My favorite Ninja Turtle, that's a great question. I'm going to have to go with Leonardo, just because his sash is blue, and blue is my favorite color. And he's a pretty smart guy, so I'll go with Leonardo. I have actually, I haven't been feeling well the last couple days, and I've taken the opportunity to watch some movies that I have not seen in a long-ass time. And one of those movies was the second Ninja Turtle movie of all things. This came out, I think, in 91. It's called The Secret of the Ooze. And I remember enjoying that second movie so much more than the first movie. And, you know, the turtle suits that they use in the movie are a little bit different, and they had this whole, you know, you learned about the origin story of how they became what they became, as far-fetched as it is, and all this stuff. And I watched the movie. I really enjoyed it. I really did. Even Kevin Nash as Super Shredder at the end of the movie. I'm surprised he didn't tear a quad. But he was a young lad back in the early 90s, so he did just fine for his 2 minutes on screen. And then I went back and I watched the first movie, which came out in 1990. Now, the movie is actually more based on, or I should say adapted from the original comic books, which I never read, but I've read for years that the comics, the original Turtle comics in the mid-80s, were far more dark and violent and bloody than the movies and the cartoons and everything else that came later on. Of course, you know, they turned it into a kid's thing, which is fine. But the movie is more adapted from the comics, and you go back and watch that first movie, it's a lot grittier and darker. It is a little bit more violent. Not too violent, but I, you know, all these years later now, being a little bit older and a little bit wiser, not for nothing, but I thoroughly enjoyed the first movie, even more so than the second one. You know? You don't have to be a kid to enjoy that first Ninja Turtles movie. If you can get past the fact that you're watching a movie with a giant talking rat and four giant talking turtles, you can appreciate the movie for what it is. And on top of that, the woman who plays April O'Neil, her name is Judith Hogue. She was an actress who, you know, she's done some other things. But as April O'Neil, the news reporter in this movie, she's pretty hot. I'm just saying. Just saying. So anyway, yeah, I've become more familiar with those movies, reacquainted, you might say, with the Ninja Turtle movies over the last couple of years. And yes, I can mention that here on my podcast, because not only is it my show, but there is a wrestling tie-in, since Kevin Nash was in one of the movies. So there you go. That's why I'm mentioning it here. So thank you for the question. There's a lot of other good questions I did not get to. I have not overlooked your questions. They're in my inbox. I have been inundated by questions. I got some questions, your people asking me to go back through some of the old Tough Enough winners and pick the people who I think should have won, and I got a bunch of other questions. I promise I will get to it at some point. I just got overwhelmed with a bunch of different things this week, so I will get to that at some point. If you have questions, though, don't stop sending them in. I want more. Email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solomonster. Now we are well over 1,000 followers and counting. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolomonster. We have a lot of fun on there, perhaps more than anywhere else. And you've got to friend me to have access to all the photos and the discussions and links and all the good stuff that goes up there. So, and perhaps I may be doing a Facebook-only mailbag at some point again in the next couple of weeks, so you got to get on there. And if you're not subscribed to this show in iTunes, go to iTunes, type in Solomonster Sounds Off, and subscribe. That's all you got to do. Anytime a new episode, a vintage episode goes up, anything like that, you will automatically have it downloaded for you. You don't have to worry, oh my God, am I going to remember? You don't have to remember anything. It will do all the work for you. So, and if you are on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes with the show, you are officially a member of the Triple Threat. And come on. Who wouldn't want to be a member? Although, there was one flaw in calling it the Triple Threat. It's called the Triple Threat because of Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes, but Triple Threat usually consists of three members, and by now we have far more than three members of our Triple Threat. So, still going to call it that, though. I think it's a cool name. So that's going to do it for this week. We're going to be back next weekend with episode 178. We've got some exciting things on the horizon, nothing I want to talk about right now, but in the next several weeks, maybe month or two, should be some cool stuff coming to SEScoops.com, courtesy of The Sound Off, so you'll want to stay tuned for all of that. Till next time, be well, stay safe. You've been listening to the longest-running episodic wrestling podcast on the internet, The Sound Off. I am the Solomonster. See you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.